You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
From the rolling bluffs of the Driftless region to the pristine shorelines of Superior in Michigan, from the Northwoods to the Kettle Moraine, Civic Media broadcasts across all of Wisconsin, for all of Wisconsin. Take a trip with us across the radio network to hear from communities throughout the state. This is the Civic Media Spotlight.
Welcome in to this week's Civic Media Spotlight. Some parents and employers are going to notice a disruption on Monday when a number of daycare providers close their doors or take other actions to call attention to how the lack of affordable childcare options has reached crisis proportions in Wisconsin. Corrine Hendrickson, a childcare provider from New Glarus, previews the fourth annual Day Without Childcare and the need for substantive childcare assistance in the next state budget. She joins Pat Kreitlow in a two-part interview.
Live across Wisconsin on Civic Media, you're listening to Mornings with Pat Kreitlow, powered by Up North News. Now, from our Lake Wissota studio, here is the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Kreitlow.
Hey, good morning. It is 7:06. Nice to have you here up north on this Tuesday morning, May 6th, 2025. Corrine Hendrickson standing by to talk to us about a day without child care. Things are going to be different for a lot of child care providers and parents next week. We'll explain what is happening. We'll be joined later this hour by Sheila Everhart of the Wisconsin Agricultural Tourism Association and our friend and dairy farmer Hans Breitenmoser, all part of National Tourism Week across the country and appreciating agricultural tourism here in Wisconsin. Still ahead in our 8 o'clock hour, we will be talking to Chad Holmes to find out the stories that he's following in the Wausau area, and Dan Schaefer from the Recombobulation area and Civic Media political editor will be joining us as well. A very busy week in the legislature, not necessarily productive, but busy. You know, we'll find out the difference in just a bit. But first, we turn to award-winning meteorologist Brittany Merlot for a forecast today that is just as bright and beautiful as her outfit today, which is this very springtime pinkish, much like the sun rises this morning. That's just a wonderful time of year. How are you, Brittany?
It really is. This is the best. You get the crisp, beautiful mornings, but the nice, warm afternoons. You guys are in short sleeves already. I love this.
That's right.
Got to rock it today. It's going to be nice.
Yeah.
All right. So right now this morning, a little crisp and cool. Superior, you're sitting at 32 degrees this morning. So right at that freezing mark. But a lot of the state is in the mid-40s and 54 degrees down southeast into West Bend. So a sunny, calm morning. There were some areas of patchy fog, but that is burning off right now. And of course, we're just going to stay bright and beautiful all day long. No complaints there. High temperatures, right? We're going to make it all the way, the entire state, into the mid to upper 70s. I do think some places far northwest will still hit 80 degrees today. It is just going to feel great, look great. But of course, if you have allergies, that pollen count is pretty high today. That's the only downside. Also, there's also a high fire danger, especially far northwest and also into central and northeastern Wisconsin. So just be careful out there of any sparks. Don't burn anything. And then tomorrow, we've got a cold front that moves through. So enjoy today. Seize the moment. Seriously.
It's short and sweet. And the forecasts are this short. It's because they're that good.
Yeah.
Just that glorious. Good morning, says Rob from Tigerton. It's sunny and 48 degrees. I made it through my colonoscopy yesterday. They found 4 polyps with hoping no cancer. That's why anyone over 45 should get one. Today I've got mowing jobs in the Wittenberg area. It's fun being on the lawn tractor, enjoying the nice weather. We mentioned Bob Seger turns 80 years old today. His favorite Bob Seger song is Still the Same. Wanted to thank his nephew, Adam, for being his driver to and from Shawano. Had a spaghetti and meatball dinner at the Shawano Cafe on Highway 22, right off 29 there in Shawano. And yes, Brittany won the awards, but Rob says all three of you are award-winning people.
Thank you, Rob.
100%. Let's get an update now on what's going to be happening with an annual event that is designed to highlight a very large growing problem. It's been building for some time. This isn't some kind of a mystery. The mystery is why there are so few politicians on one side of the aisle that want to take it seriously. So Corrine Hendrickson is here, a child care provider from the New Glarus area, to talk about a day without child care next week. Corrine, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I am good, and I'm excited about being outside all day today.
I know.
Yes, you get a rare day off as you're getting the planning going for a day without childcare. Let's start with that, the 30,000 foot view. What is it? How did it come to be?
So 4 years ago, the Day Without Childcare began with the Childcare Changemakers Community Change Organization. And it really was because before COVID, there was already an issue already across the country, half of family childcare closed in the last decade. And so during COVID, it was our opportunity to really help remind people, like, you're begging us to stay open. And without us, you cannot work. It doesn't matter if there's a health issue or not. It doesn't matter what's going on. Childcare is always necessary, needed. And so this is something that my colleague, Brooke Legler, and I have really helped push in our entire state. We have had the most events across the country in our state the last 4 years running. Right now, we're behind by a couple. So we're asking our colleagues who are planning events to put it on the map. So there's a childcarechangemakers.org, and you can go to the map and you can find out what events are close to you to attend. And all of them are open to the public.
So some of these are events designed to highlight the problem, to educate people about the problem, but there will be providers that are either not going to be open that day or making some other accommodations to essentially illustrate how bad things could get, right?
Oh, absolutely. So some of us are closing and having community events. Some of us are staying open and having elected representatives come in and have conversations with their parents and their teachers. Some of us are staying open and having parents, before they can leave their child for the day, write to their elected representatives, especially with the budget season, asking for that $480 million investment. We also have some stickers that parents can wear, and we're asking all parents, whether they have care that they pay for or that they have a family friend, neighbor, the other parent is home while they work, to make stickers or buttons and wear them and that says, without childcare, I couldn't be here today. Because we keep hearing from people that, I don't have young kids, this doesn't affect me. Well, if every single person who relies on care is wearing a sticker when people are going around that day, they're going to realize how many people they interact require that care and how it does impact them and why it's important that we as a state finally invest a single dollar into the childcare system instead of relying on federal dollars.
I'm really glad that in the historical overview, you brought it back to the pandemic notion of essential workers. It helped us understand just how vital certain parts of the economy are. Not that every job isn't important, but at its bare roots, even in a pandemic, there are things that still need to operate, but can't operate if people aren't working there, and people aren't working there if there's not childcare centers. And it really, in my mind, shows the difference between what you're asking for from the legislature as an investment in the economy, in the workforce, versus the way other people describe it as some kind of a handout.
Yeah, absolutely. And I appreciate you bringing that up. Yeah, COVID revealed the issues, the structural issues that were happening, and gave us an opportunity to use that federal funding that all of us on the ground advocated really hard for, and to use that in ways to show that it really truly is about the wages for the teachers. If we cannot pay our teachers more than $13 an hour, who's going to work for us? And what quality are you going to have? Because they're going to be stressed and burnt out, because if you're only making $13 an hour, you're not taking care of yourself or your family appropriately. And you're working multiple jobs, and then you're supposed to be, you know, happy and excited and meet the needs of four infants who are crying because they're hungry or need to be held or rocked or want attention. It's just absurd that we expect people to do this and have continued to expect people to do this, because for some reason, women are just supposed to be kind and caring and giving. And, you know, some of us just deserve to, like, be paid in hugs and love, I guess. So, yeah, that's why we've been doing these community conversations as well. So tonight at Brooks Cider at 6 p.m., we will be having a community conversation about childcare and why it's so important.
And really, apart from, you know, the provider themselves, again, the nice ladies who do it out of the goodness of their heart, I think it's worth mentioning. I mean, there are so many different figures involved in this. There's the provider, but there's also maybe the provider has an employer of a center. So you've got those two right there. Then you've got the parent as a third important building block. But that fourth block, the workplace that depends on having these folks and who suffer when a parent, usually but not always a mom, says we can't find or keep affordable daycare. And so that business loses some very valued employees. And like you said, we knew this was going on before COVID. Just from a demographic standpoint, it's only getting worse and calling out for some kind of an attention.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it's one of those things where a lot more employers are starting to take notice again. I've had employers calling me you know, asking if I have space. And I always am like, no, and your person called me as well. But they're having difficulties finding care, and they're trying finding care for their employees so that their employee can get to work. And so they're trying to do things. So that's, you know, valuable time that the HR is spending doing, you know, something that's not really part of the business, but an absolute integral part of the business. Because if you don't have people that can come, then you don't have employees. And another thing is, we keep hearing from people that, you know, people just don't want to work. Well, we keep pushing back on that. We're like, no, people want to work. They can't get there. Why can't they get there? They don't have affordable housing. They don't have reliable transportation. They don't have care for their child. And really getting those conversations to be more curious and deeper, and having a conversation instead of judging and assuming that people just don't want to work because they're lazy.
Yeah, we've got Tony posts on YouTube out of the Ashland area. Washburn School has a daycare. It has an 18-month wait list. And I recall that happening with my one daughter who, again, having their first child and finding out, you know, there's this 18-month wait list when it's like they just found out they're pregnant. And, you know, that's how serious things have become to this point, and why we need the legislature to be paying attention to an issue like this. We're talking to Corrine Hendrickson from New Glarus about a day without child care and the events that are going to be going on as a result of it. Corrine, is there one particular website where people should go to if they want to learn more about the day and the issue?
Yeah, the Community Change Day Without Child Care. There's a map website, and I can mail it to you so we can put it in your
Yep. Oh, you know what? I see it right here. CommunityChangeAction.org. Again, CommunityChangeAction.org, and on there you'll see A Day Without Child Care. And like you said, there's a map and much more about the issue that we're talking about with Corrine Hendrickson. Here's a little sports at 7:18. The Milwaukee Brewers got back in the win column again, got back to 500 on the season, defeating the Houston Astros on Monday night, 5-1. Christian Yelich hit a two-run home run. Tobias Myers pitched 5 1/3 strong innings. Yelich's homer came in his 1,500th career game. It also broke an 0-for-19 slump, so that was some good news. Nothing like the one that Vinny Capra was suffering from. The Brewer third baseman was in an 0-for-36 slump until he got a single last night in the eighth inning. It was his first hit since April 2nd. They will be hosting the Houston Astros again tonight and then again tomorrow afternoon. Coverage of this evening's game starts at 6:05 on Civic Media stations in Richland Center, in Oshkosh, in Racine, Kenosha, Park Falls, and the newest Brewers affiliate, WBZH, in Hayward. Yet to come today, we will be talking in just over an hour to Dan Schaefer from the Recombobulation area about what the legislature is up to this week, including some retreads, bills that have been vetoed by Governor Evers, sometimes repeatedly. And yet, that's what they're doing again in Madison this week, instead of things like solving the child care crisis. From the heart of America's up north, live from Lake Wissota, thanks for making this the place to spend a part of your mornings. I'm Pat Kreitlum.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Welcome back to the Civic Media Spotlight. This is part two of Pat Kreitlow's interview with Corrine Hendrickson, a child care advocate, on to discuss Monday's fourth annual Day Without Child Care. To hear more of all of these shows, download the Civic Media app on the Google Play or Apple App Store, or check out the shows after the fact as a podcast on Spotify, Apple Music, or at civicmedia.us.
Coming up this afternoon on the Maggie Dawn Show, I'm sorry, the award-winning Maggie Dawn Show, Jeremy Janine from Urban Milwaukee, and Jim Santel, former U.S. attorney, friend of our program as well, will be joining Maggie Dawn for her program a little later on this afternoon. And it's new time, 4 to 6 o'clock here across the Civic Media Radio Network. Let's continue our conversation on A Day Without Child Care with Corrine Hendrickson and New Glarus. And let's get into the specific policy that the legislature should be working on. And as I covered a minute ago, they seem to be focused on other things right now. But what is the best case scenario coming out of this state budget that the legislature and the governor could potentially reach agreement on?
Well, the best case scenario was that we get at least $480 million in state investment, and that money would then be able to go toward wages so that we can increase wages for our educators without having to increase prices for tuition. Without any funding, we actually all will be losing about 15% of our revenue, and that cost will have to be, you know, pushed onto the parents in order for us to stay open. And there was a survey that just came out in April that we had kind of talked about, and 25% of us are looking at probably closing. We won't close right away necessarily. Some definitely will. Others will close after they raise their rates and not enough families can continue to afford them. And then they end up closing because they can't pay their teachers. Family child care will close because we can't pay our mortgage and aren't about to let ourselves go bankrupt and lose our homes. We'll find a different job. So at the end of the day, those of us in the field will likely be okay. Those of us with young children will have a little harder time, but those of us in the field will be okay. We can get other jobs, but the parents and their children, they're not going to be okay. Our communities are not going to be okay. And so, you know, really making sure that we get that investment is imperative.
Right. And you note here, Greene County, for example, is looking at a loss of up to 50% of their regulated childcare programs. 44% predict at least closing a room due to a loss of teachers. And then, of course, an average increase per child of $26 on top of what it already costs more now, which is just downright shocking for those of us who haven't had kids in daycare for a very long time. But I want to seize on that one word there in that sentence, losing the amount of regulated child care programs. And for folks who say, well, you know, I was raised by my aunt and uncle and I was just fine, there's a whole reason why we've been moving over time toward child care centers that are licensed, inspected, healthy and safe, that I imagine you can tell people about.
Yeah, so regulated care is, we have basic health and safety standards. So, you know, even people who are only watching one or two children, they can be certified and they can get that base level of education so that they understand what it is that they're doing, because 90% of that brain development happens in these first 5 years. So along with the fact that children died or were injured, that was part of why the regulation came. But then all the other part was because we learned how much important brain matter and brain development was happening and how that happens. And that's really those close relationships with a consistent caregiver. So even people like who can have neighbors and family, if that child isn't going to the same person consistently, they don't know where they are, what they're doing. They're interacting with different people. They don't know what the expectations are. And so that impedes their development, and that sets them up on a trajectory of a lifetime of difficulty that's completely unnecessary. And so really looking at it as, you know, making sure we have the health and safety, making sure that the people doing the work understand the importance of the work, and that includes parents who choose to and can stay home. We need to have opportunities for them to interact with people. We need to have, you know, places for them to go so they understand how to play with their child or how, what's going on developmentally, so that if something is happening that maybe they could use a little bit extra support for, they know how to talk to birth three. They know how to talk to the school district. And so really looking at it as a whole system of, you know, we need to make sure that our children are cared for and educated from the earliest possible moment. And most of that comes from high, loving, quality relationships.
Tony notes on YouTube, speaking as the dad of a five-year-old, a three-year-old, and a two-month-old, this is not okay, the situation that we have right now, which is completely understandable. So when people look at this, and obviously there is this idea to go through the state budget and provide support that way, and I'm going to set that aside. This is not an either or, but people are looking at other creative ways of addressing this problem. We have had reports of how school districts have looked to open up their own child care centers because they feel like they're the only ones who can be the provider in their small community. Employers have sometimes tried to band together and try to work out something. So this is more than just a line item in a state budget bill, Corrine. We're talking that this is a time for outside the box thinking on how to preserve safe and affordable childcare.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But looking at it in a way to make sure that every child has opportunities, we cannot rely on school districts who have property tax owners who are willing and able to spend more money. We cannot look at employers who have the profit margin necessary and needed in order to open up a childcare for their employees' children, or for them to be able to contract with those of us outside. So if we really want to make a system that every single child has opportunity, with every single employer having the ability to have high quality care for their employees, especially nonprofits, especially our sheriff and our fire and our EMS and all the rest government entities that don't have the capabilities of doing that, they don't have the funding, we really need to look at a systemic change. So whether that's a sales tax increase, whether that is a capital gains tax increase, whether that's employers do a 0.05% or something like that, payroll tax, like Vermont has done very, very successfully, I might add, because what that does is it adds revenue. Whatever it is, we have to have something that's going to add revenue without it being on the parents to pay for. Other than that, there's just no way it'll work.
Corrine Hendrickson here from Cassandra on YouTube. While we were on a waiting list, our kids went to an unlicensed person, and I know it contributed to my youngest's speech delay. Also had to emergently pull our son out of that house because he had fallen off a scooter twice with no helmet, and more that resulted from it. It was just not a good situation compared to a regulated child care center, which is what we're all fighting for here. Corrine, thank you again for the time so much. I know how busy you are organizing this, and we wish you all the best. Thanks for getting up early with us today.
Thanks.
Okay, we'll see you again real soon. Coming up later in the program today, we're going to be talking to Chad Holmes. We'll be talking to Dan Schaefer. We have another check-in with meteorologist Brittany Merlot. But first, Hans Breitenmoser and Sheila Everhart will be talking about agricultural tourism in the state. Thanks for spending part of your mornings here, powered by Up North News on the Civic Media Radio Network. I'm Pat Kreitlow.
Mornings with Pat Kreitlow is affiliated with the Civic Media Radio Network and airs on select Civic Media stations weekday mornings from 6 until 9. To learn more about this show and all of the Civic Media programming, check out the website at civicmedia.us/shows.
Welcome back to the Civic Media Spotlight. We go now to the Maggie Dawn Show, and this week Maggie welcomed on Dave Schrader, Research Director for the Wisconsin Security Research Consortium. He highlights vulnerabilities in national infrastructure and the insidious nature of disinformation campaigns. Dave reminds us that in the age of disinformation, the goal is not always to separate us from our money, but to separate us from reality.
Back, everybody. Welcome if you're just joining us. My name is Maggie Dawn, host of this, The Maggie Dawn Show, here on the Civic Media Radio Network. We've dedicated today's program to cyber threats to our families, to our kids, to ourselves. And we're going to expand that discussion into much bigger questions of national security, election security, our infrastructure. We've got a fabulous expert with us. His name is Dave Schrader. He's the UW Madison Research Director for the Wisconsin Security Research Consortium, which is home to the Wisconsin Information Security Center. I love a good acronym salad. We'll just call Dave a cyber dork. His words, not mine. Thank you so much, Dave. We've been talking about how people can help secure their own online presence, the sort of hallmarks of these scams to look out for, the creating a false sense of urgency, often appearing to come from a family member or close friend, ultimately all inexorably moving towards two outcomes, which is directly separating you from your money or getting you to give up sensitive information that then allows them to access your money. It's always about the money.
That's right.
So I'll just make this observation at a really high level. It seems to me that in all governments, technology leads And we then struggle to catch up with it. And we're legislating sort of from behind where the apex or the front of the technology is. And that has certainly been the case when it comes to, for example, the crime of sextortion, revenge porn, another thing that people, you know, gosh, what do we do about this? These were adults. And certainly it also falls in this area of just trying to secure people's personal information and what are the responsibilities of these platforms on which information is shared and these schemes are carried out. Dave, you're an expert. You study this way more than I could ever hope to get even a small slice of understanding about. When you think of really common sense policy or legislation that we should be talking about and asking our elected officials about, what are some, what I term low-hanging, obvious, yes, we need to do that policy or legislation?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And, you know, part of the reason why this does not exist is because it's hard. It's hard to do, and not everyone's going to agree on how to do it. And there are, there's compelling commercial interests on the side of all these platforms that, you know, don't want legislation that stops them from doing various things. And so what we end up with is this patchwork of laws that are different in every state, and some states don't have them at all, whether it is on things like privacy or sextortion or cybersecurity. And they're very reactive in nature. And it creates this situation that we're in now, where it feels like, you know, things are happening only after the fact, and that technology is kind of running away with everything. And that's a true, you know, even more so with things like artificial intelligence and the things that you see with deepfakes and right. And revenge porn that used to be, you know, actual sensitive pictures of someone that are now just, you know, completely
AI.
Made up.
Yep.
Yeah, they're made with AI, and one tool goes away and two new tools pop up. So, you know, to get to your question though of what can be done from a policy standpoint, I think that legislators, whether it's in a state or at the federal level, need to find things that we can agree on in a bipartisan way. And I think that protection of children online is one of the things that we can all get behind. And so one thing I wanted to talk about that wasn't touched on at all so far during this conversation is that the platforms could make this a lot harder for scammers with some pretty simple things. And I'll give you one example. One of them is, and obviously people can use, you know, fake birth dates and all those things. But if you come on and create, like, let's say an Instagram account as a 14-year-old or something like that, and you use your real birth date, which a lot of kids do when they're creating their account, it knows that it's a child's account. It could make the account private by default, direct messages private by default. And that one change alone would stop a lot of this in its tracks. And I just want to also mention to parents or kids who are listening, or anyone who has an account, you can, you know, make these changes to your account. And as a parent, it is really incumbent on us to take the time to understand how these things work, whether it's the parental controls on iOS or Android, or the settings in things like Instagram and TikTok. And so, you know, you can sit down and say, okay, look, let's make the account private. Let's make sure that the DMs are set to only people that you know or that you're connected to. And you know, the Yahoo boys and a lot of the scammers, they're just going to move on to the next target who doesn't have a private Instagram account. Now, does that maybe mean that you don't, you know, you're not as open with people who might want to connect with you, or, you know, everyone has that fear of missing out. You know, no one wants, well, what if that person, what if that girl that I met at the party, like, wants to reach out to me and DM me and we're not connected on Instagram. Like, you really need to lock these things down. And the platforms leave them open and public by default, because it's good for their business model. Because being open and it's good for engagement, is what it comes down to.
And engagement drives the money. That's what the platforms are built on. So I am a huge nerd about behavioral economics, and no one turned the channel because it's the econ version of what Dave's saying. And basically, the principle that Dave and I are talking about is to understand how humans actually behave and make the technology account for that. In other words, have the defaults on these platforms set to private. It does take time for parents, and I have taken the time, not perfectly, to go down the rabbit hole. It takes forever to find all of the privacy settings. For example, and this is just a stupid one, Dave, but I wanted to bring it up, Venmo. Your entire contact list on Venmo is public, and it's a different privacy setting than is your transaction setting public. Yep. It's two different things, and they do this all over the place. I think that's an incredibly important tip, Dave. Because we've got limited time, one, will you please come back with me, and we will have a longer form discussion about this. And secondly, we just saw, I want to talk about cybersecurity from a national security perspective. We just saw in Spain and Portugal what appeared potentially to be a hack shut down their grid. How are we doing here in the U.S.? Do we have good grid cybersecurity infrastructure?
Well, some of you may have heard of this thing called Volt Typhoon. Which is a name that we've given some of the Chinese government hacking activities that have breached pretty much all sectors of critical infrastructure in the United States over a period of several years, and was designed, you know, we've come out and really publicly said this, was designed to essentially stage on our critical infrastructure so that the Chinese government could, at a time and place of their choosing, for instance, in the event of an invasion of Taiwan, take action in these sectors, whether it is shutting down, you know, water treatment facilities, pieces of the grid, and probably coinciding with pretty aggressive information operations, meaning, you know, targeted propaganda, actual fake news, video clips, things of that nature on platforms like TikTok, which is controlled by ByteDance, which is a Chinese company. And there's no such thing as a private company in China, especially when you have political officers at the company that are beholden to the Chinese Communist Party. So we're not doing well when it comes to the overall cybersecurity of our critical infrastructure. And it's not because there aren't good people doing good work and trying to keep things secure. It's just that we have such, again, a patchwork of systems, of processes, of capabilities, with the resources that go into these things are kind of all over the place. So you have large, municipalities like New York City that are very well prepared. You have states that have put a lot of money at the state level, like Texas, into cybersecurity. And then you have the have-nots, smaller school districts, smaller utilities, smaller counties that don't have the same resources. And so that's why, you know, I think there's concern over the cuts that CISA, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency at the federal level, is now facing. And You know, I look at this holistically. It's not just the technical. You know, with something like critical infrastructure security, yes, there's a technical component, but a lot of the nation state cyber actors like Russia and China also have a component to their attacks that are in the information domain to cause destabilization, to cause people to lose trust in institutions, whether it is media, whether it is government, whether it is elections. And we've seen this play out time and time and time again in Europe, in Africa, in the United States. This is this is part of their playbook. And it's, you know, this is foreign adversary aggression. And I hope that's something that as Americans, we can all agree needs to be something that we defend against.
Folks, that's Dave Schroeder. He's the UW-Madison Research Director for the Wisconsin Security Research Consortium. Dave, will you stick around for one more segment? Because I want to ask you about the idea of disinformation and destabilization and mistrust of institutions and how people can be savvier consumers of information online. What are some of the hallmarks of those things? Just like we were talking about the hallmarks of misinformation. Do you have time for another segment, my friend?
Yes.
Oh, wonderful. Folks, if you have a question, Jack from Merrimack, I know you are on the lines. I didn't get to you. Please text it in 855-752-4842, 855-75-CIVIC. You touched upon something that I think is really important. And if you could expand on this, and then we'll kind of talk about some best practices when we come back when it comes to disinformation. Cyber warfare, cyber attacks aren't just about shutting down a grid or shutting down an air traffic control system. They rely upon and interact with the cyber-based disinformation, misinformation, destabilization, information environment. That's what you're saying, right, Dave? I'm hearing that correctly. These are related phenomena.
Well, there's always a human element in any of these chains that we're talking about. You can have purely technical attacks, but these are systems that are all run and mediated by humans, and humans are the weakest link.
Folks, we're going to come back. We're going to talk about the threat that online external nation state adversarial actors, the online destabilization campaigns that we face here and abroad. Keep it locked. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to The Maggie Dawn Show on the Civic Media Radio Network.
The Maggie Dawn Show is part of the Civic Media Radio Network and airs across the network weekday afternoons from 4 until 6. To learn more about this show and all of the Civic Media programming, check out the website at civicmedia.us/shows.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Wrapping up the first hour of this week's Civic Media Spotlight, we go to the John and Gordy Show down in Madison. John and Gordy welcomed on Dr. Tim Slecker, one half of the Busted Pencils team here on Civic Media. They're talking about AI and its impact on critical thinking skills. While it can both help and hurt these skills, we have to ask ourselves, is it really the tool causing the problem?
It's John and Gordy's Media World again, right here on WMDX 92.7. And right now we're talking to Tim Slecker from Busted Pencils, and we want to continue the conversation in regards to AI, and will it make people intellectually lazy? What do you think, Tim?
That's assuming people aren't already intellectually lazy.
Yeah, it won't make them. They're already that way.
They're already there.
All right, I'll try to get to this quickly.
Okay.
Within that joke, though, is the reality of going, have schools, have its education ever really done a great job with that? I think that's debatable. When people make that claim, I think that's more personally about who they are and how they think. And then when they use AI, they see that it could and potentially, and I don't disagree, that it can create shortcuts that would actually then take away students engaging in skills that are actually really needed to move this along. However, I would say, and you guys, you know, made this comment either in between the breaks, it comes down to like anything, how do you use it and what is the intention be how between about how it's being used, because I see nothing but expanding and deepening and actually enticing more critical thinking because of the way it can actually get you to think about things you didn't consider when you put it in there. But that also then requires that we prepare students about how to ask better questions, how to dig deeper. And so that to me says is that that goes back to just what does it mean to be a good teacher, to have a good education curriculum, is that are we developing that intellectual curiosity? Because somebody who has intellectual curiosity, AI expands and actually creates this sense of going, I didn't know I could ask these questions. I didn't know I could dig this way. I didn't know that I can put together these two things and ask it to find out what are the commonalities between this. So it's an incredibly powerful tool. Will it potentially be used by people to shortcut around things that they should have known? Absolutely. But, you know, guess what? From the yellow Cliff Notes when it came to reading Shakespeare in the 80s, I used them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Like we all did. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, if there is a shortcut to doing sometimes, and this is the other thing, doing sometimes meaningless work that is really just busy work, people will find shortcuts. So this really comes down to the institutions of learning to really start to reimagine what is it they're asking students to do. And if it is something that AI could do much easier, then maybe the assignment, maybe the activity you're engaging in needs to be adapted to recognize now that actually being lazy is really easy, but maybe the assignments were actually encouraging lazy intellectual curiosity.
That's true. You know, I guess when you were first talking about this way back when, you did bring up a few examples of, you know, what students would experience if they entered this into AI and got a response back. A lot of the students would question immediately some of the information that they did see from the AI answer and actually maybe even create a curiosity about that information. So they investigate to find out if it's true or not, or how true it is, or if there's even more information tied to that situation, right?
Right. But I mean, again, you know, that is the intentions to even do that. And as you're saying that now, John, I mean, you know, how about just a simple assignment where, you know, we put together a list of, quote, facts and engage students in saying, okay, are these true? And if so, how do you know? Here's an AI tool. Go.
Right. Right.
You know, and then come back and tell us what you learned about, you know, oh, this fact, this is nonsense. In fact, here's what we found out. That inspires critical thinking, digging, research skills, learning what it says, right? So I understand the fact that there are going to be students who are going to say, oh my God, this is a shortcut and I'm going to use it. Okay, that's always going to happen. So, but we need to then think about going, maybe it's the assignments and the workload that we've been giving that we now need to change and recognize that, you know what, this is way more efficient than those yellow Cliff Notes that we had. and, you know, and
they always ran out on the ones that you really needed for the next day's assignment. You know, you go to the store and they're all gone.
Society didn't collapse because of the Cliff Notes either.
No, it didn't. But you know, Sam said this during the break. The other part, though, too, is if you have a critical thinking base. And so, yeah, we need to really develop critical thinking. And maybe that's outside of AI. But I can tell you the other part is that if you really know, you know, something, like I said, I just enjoy the way it expands my thinking about the things I think I already know a lot about.
That's right. Mm-hmm. I remember the discussion was, you know, come up with a topic on Abraham Lincoln and quotes from Abraham Lincoln. Remember that example?
Yeah.
And then, you know, Abraham Lincoln's dialogue in the movie Abraham Lincoln Vampire Hunter would turn up in the research.
Yeah.
not a good thing. Not so don't include that.
No.
Dr. Tim Slegger, we need to leave it there. People can find your podcast on the Civic Media app and also through WMDXradio.com. It's on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays with new podcasts.
That's right.
Then Saturdays as well.
Hour-long program.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Tim,
mm-hmm.
always great to talk to you.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Take care.
Talk to you next Thursday.
Yeah.
This portion of the John and Gordy Show brought to you by our friends at Verlo Mattress of Madison. One thing that remains constant since they opened the doors in 1958, they're still direct to consumers, providing you superior products at unbeatable prices. Two locations in Madison, East Side and West Side, or go to verlo.com. Talking to attorney Jim Santel in our next hour and Shondell Marks and Madison Malone about a big show in Baraboo. Stay with us for more of John and Gordy. Right?
Yeah, do that.
Oh, okay, do that.
Let the sun shine. The John and Gordy Show.
The John and Gordy Show is part of the Civic Media Radio Network and airs on WMDX weekday mornings from 6 until 8. To learn more about this show and all of the Civic Media programming, check out the website at civicmedia.us/shows.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.